Accession number 8433, Real One.
Yeah, the idea was that you would be on patrol 1 minute, working from a central base, and you go out to the jungle maybe a week or 14 days or maybe longer. Then suddenly they'd switch you from that to guarding consuls, which were barbed wire townships, as it were, where the workers for a plantation or an area would live, sleep, and live their life. But they were only allowed out, and they were checked by you, and your job was not only to protect them, partly, but also to make sure none of them took any food out. You tasted everything they took out and make sure it had no sugar in it. You searched out all the men. The women were searched by police women. And so the boys, first of all, when they heard they were going to be searching, thought, well, good, women, but no chance. That was done by the women policemen. So we never knew where we were going to go, and they didn't know when we were going to come. The idea was to cut off the bandit food supply, and then you revert back again into the jungle.
Did you find it an unpleasant duty having to...
To do this, to search men, and I felt that the whole thing, if I was in their position, I thought, my God, I would be fighting possibly against the British. Certainly, I certainly wouldn't be working for them. I disliked Dunlop in particular, because they never... I mean, one of the things, if you went into a town...
I'll stop you, I don't do it.
You're on leave and you're walking down the road and you see a white man and you say good afternoon or good morning, whatever. You got no reply, and then you think they'd snub you. And I felt this was a bit irksome. You could understand it if it was their daughter or their wife or somebody other that was snubbing you, but it was a man who would snub you. And you were just walking down that street and you think, so for God's sake, well, you're white, they're white, what on earth's the matter? But that was their attitude, that you were nothing. But you felt particularly irksome when you had to be on, for instance, IA, immediate action. You were called out and you expected to be on that lorry within 2 minutes for every single thing that you needed to do anything, to go anywhere, and go out and rescue them from being attacked or ambushed or whatever in their houses. They expected that. They expected that, and you got no thanks from them at all. The only time...
Got you down.
The thing that got you down really was the officers. One particular officer I had, that I hated his guts, and I think it was an unusual sort of feeling. He came out. We didn't have an officer for ages because officers were in short supply to start with, so we only had this sergeant, which we carried. And why we carried him, God alone knows, I don't really understand myself looking back, but I suppose we felt sorry for him in some ways. But when we had an officer that did come out, I realised that the boys themselves weren't that bright in some ways, but I realised that he was only interested in one thing: killing as many people as possible, that is bandits, and getting yourself a name, getting yourself a reputation. Our battalion had a terrific reputation, and so that's why we were fairly safe. We had 7 kills in no time out there. So the bandits were a little bit wary of the Queens, and they used this. They used this to their advantage, that is the high command. We would sometimes go out with empty trucks, just 2 men to a truck, and they would be poking their heads out the back from behind the canvas, and we'd have the Queen's flag, and we'd drive around and we'd stop at a concert or a village, which would be miles off the track of where we were, and then the inhabitants would think, ah, the Queens are coming. And so this way we hoped to flush the bandits out of that area, because the word would go out into our area. Sometimes it would be for real that we would go, sometimes we wouldn't. And then you had the peculiar instance that when you went into the jungle, as I said, noise carries every time, which was absolutely infuriating, every time. So the rubber tappers would bang their buckets and you'd hear the handles go clang, 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 way into the distance, just to warn the bandits, if they were about, that you're coming. And so you knew the population was against you. You felt that every parisher was against you, because when you got back to camp, the officers made your life hell. Some were worse than others. I mean, some were pretty easygoing guys and decent sort of fellows, but some could be particular swines. And the ones I say that I didn't like, my father was ill, and I...
Can I stop you? I don't want you to get too far off, won't you?
Mm-hmm.
What was...
Well, as you could, it was certainly so that you did...
So start again, as far as the National Servicemen were concerned...
Well, as far as the National Servicemen, in fact, as far as everyone was concerned, the regulars usually were... a high percentage of them were drunkards. those that weren't were pretty good. But the thing was, one thing you all had in common. But the officers, you had this gripe, because the officers would be changed. You were staying there all the time. The officers would occasionally have it easy. They'd miss patrols. You wouldn't. All the time you were at it. Now, so you learnt to wear a new officer down. One of the ways you did this was when you went on patrol, you'd lift Roots up and you'd trip him over. And when he got used to falling over half a dozen times, then you'd bring back these ATAP-type palms, and they had big lancing great spurs on the end of them, hooks, and you'd catch it with your rifle and you'd bring it all the way back, and then you'd let it whip back in his face. Now, when he got used to looking for these things, he'd be looking upwards all the time, you realised he began to latch on to looking upwards, then you start lifting the Roots again. If you did this on one or two patrols, eventually you'd wear him down to the kind of state you were in. The next thing is they send you on five-finger patrols. That is, they'd make a main camp into the jungle, maybe 2 or 3 days marching. You didn't count it in miles, you counted the jungle time in days, from first light to last light. Last light was stand two, and first light was stand two. That is, you stood two on guard, everybody. Well, the five-finger patrol was if you laid your hand down, your five fingers or your thumb and four fingers splayed out. That is a point of the compass, and you take 2-3 men, and off you go. Now, the idea was that you go out for half a day and then you come back. If you saw anything on the way out, you would come back and you'd report it. And then you'd go out as a unit to attack it or take it. Now, in the end, we soon latched onto the ideas that this was a rest for the officers and damned hard work for us. So we got to the point where regulars and everybody concerned would go about 50 to 25 yards out, sit down, have a smoke for about 4 or 5 hours, then get a water bottle out, splash it all under your arms, splash it over your face, and then come plonking back in, after, of course, having in between time studying the map, and come back in and you give your report. What did you see? Ah, well, we went through some marsh, then we went up over this very rocky sort of ground, and then we come up against an obstacle. We had to get round that, and give them some cock and bull story, but always everyone's story tallied. Ambushes, so far as the bandit was concerned, which was most annoying, you felt so bloody minded about it, was the fact that they would hit you and then run. If it was in a convoy when they hit you, if you were travelling, then you had immediate actions that you would take. The scout car would drive straight up to the trench, firing brain guns, 2 brain guns mounted on the top, with a light mounted.
Sorry, I've got to stop.
When the bandits opened up on you, you drive straight in with a scout car. This was our immediate action. If they picked a part where the scout car could get at it. If not, then the lorries pulled into the side so that the immediately 4 chaps on each side of each corner of the truck would then lob out smoke grenades to give you cover. You'd then disperse as quick as you could over the other side. But normally, if the bandits laid an ambush, they would have it on a bend and they'd usually hit you from the tail, not usually from the front, because they knew the scout car couldn't turn round. So always on a corner, you were on the lookout. You were on the ready to make one leaping bound over the side of a truck. In fact, that was the thing we practiced, jumping off of trucks on the move. It was a thing that we used particularly at night time, night patrols, where a lorry would be going uphill and it would be going reasonably slow, 15, 20 miles an hour. You leapt off. The thing you had to watch is that you didn't jump into a telegraph pole or a tree or something like this because you'd do yourself a mischief. But often as not, no one so much as sprained an ankle, yet you had full marching kit with you. The bandits weren't even aware that you'd disembust. The lorries would carry on going and you were then off into the jungle or off after them, where you suspected they may be. This was just one way.
Just to give one kind.
Then the other type of ambush is the ambush that we would lay down. We would go and try and get in while it was still just light enough to see what you was doing. And this is what we call an area ambush. It consisted mainly of, say, if you were doing a nice job, preferably 3 Vickers machine guns. Now, you imagine a triangle. You have a Vickers machine gun at each corner of the triangle, and its line of fire is fixed on a carriage so that it can spray up and down, and it can spray side to side, but not only to within a few yards of the other Vickers machine gun. A Vickers machine gun at 1,000 yards, so they told me, would cut you clean in half. They weren't usually that far apart. But anything within that field of fire was literally going to be decimated, absolutely. There was no way out of that. Once they were in, that was the finish. There was no chance of them getting out, unless they lay flat on the deck. But then you had troops anyway, and they would have closed in, and once the firing had stopped, they'd be up and they'd just march through, or they'd wait till first light and march through and collect what was there. Now, if you didn't manage to catch any of these characters and they went into the consies, because the consies obviously weren't being guarded, and I used to feel sorry for the poor souls in the consies because the bullets would go whizzing through their huts, not much probably above the height that they were sleeping at. You usually had a man that had given himself up. He would be hooded, or he'd be in a trap with just a slit, one of our armoured bastards or something like this, which is a big metal lorry that was armour plated, and you couldn't see into it. All you had was a rifle slit to see out. And he would then pick out the people in that camp that he knew were either supporters of the communists or were, in actual fact, communists. Although everybody had a pass, that pass didn't mean to say that they weren't a communist. In fact, one classic example I remember walking along, where you can so easily sort of think, oh, this, everything's okay, it's cool. We were told to expect bandits. We were doing another kind of sweep that you would do. That was a box. Now, a box consisted of troops on three sides of a square. You knew the bandits were in there somewhere. And the third side, the fourth side, would move up between them. And eventually, you'd hope to pin the bandits down. Now, we were doing one of these sweeps and marching through. I had the shotgun at this time. Within seconds, I just had this, again, this almost sixth sense feeling that something was coming from behind this bush. As the person appeared, so my shotgun was up, safety catch off, and finger on the trigger. It was only a question of just touching that trigger, and he would have been blasted to hell. As it was, he was carrying a pole with a couple of cans on it each side. And so, with my left hand, holding my shotgun in position, ready to blast him to pieces, I beckoned him forward, Marasinia, which means come here. He came here, I asked for his passport, looked at it. Okay, it tallied, and obviously it was just a workman that had wandered in there somehow or the other, God knows how. But this was one way they had of catching them, but the only trouble was, again, you hated the Malayan policemen, because when they escaped, it was always through the Malayan policemen. And this was one of their main supplies of ammunition and of arms. The cardinal rule was that you never shot at anything until you recognised the target. The flashes you wore on your hat were changed periodically. On one occasion I can remember, we were fording across a waterfall. I was part of the way across, and I was leading scout at the time, and in a very precarious position, because when I looked up, I saw this patrol crossing the river higher up, but I couldn't see the flashes on their hat, so I could not recognise them as friend or foe. And I knew that we had finger patrols out, whether they were our boys or whether they were bandits, so we were moving at a fair rate. But I thought myself, we were in too sticky a position to try and open fire anyway. So the only thing to do was try and get up there and see what it was all about. But by the time we got there, it was hard to say what exactly had gone on. But that was one of the faults that I thought, with the idea of the flash being at the front and back, was all very well. But from a sideways view, you couldn't tell. From a distance, anyway. When you were close up, you could, because their hats were self-made things, their putties were different to us, they didn't wear socks, they wore bits of cloth, and inside their boots that was, instead of socks, just a piece of cloth wrapped over their foot, and their foot stuffed into a little hockey boot, and they had a uniform of such. When we did used to shoot them, the first thing the boys did was whip their boots off, because that's where they kept their money. And then we'd take it back and it'd be split up and we'd have a big booze up to forget all about it. The other thing was that the lads out there before us, they had to bring back the head and the hands. They used to just chop them off, so we were told. We weren't allowed to do that because everyone was disgusted with the idea of it. The people at decide all these things, we had to bring back the whole body. Well, I never had the unpleasant task of bringing back a body, but a body that's been out there for 3 days or so, depoted. The bandit's greatest asset was the jungle, because he knew it inside out, backwards and forwards, and we didn't to begin with. But eventually you felt as safe as they were in it, because you became as good as them at it, and so you eliminated that weapon for them. But going into it was always very dicey, because they could be waiting for you, and coming out of it the same thing applied again. You were in both cases exposed. Once you were in the jungle, you weren't exposed. You were then in your element, the thing that you had been trying to do. And so when you were out in the open, you felt naked. You felt like someone had taken away your armour. And that is possibly the reason why I developed hypophobia. And from that...
this occasion?
Well, we was on Mount Ipo, and we were walking along. Now, most things you didn't see, they saw you or they smelt you and they were away. But the e-bomb that was tracking suddenly stopped me, and we could be quite friendly, stopped me and pointed into the bush, and I'm looking into this, this very loose jungle, and suddenly I saw this thing, almost, as you know, as a chicken sort of jerks, that kind of jerky movement the chicken has when it goes up and down. This jerky movement, it jerked, looked at you, and remained stationary. So again, it blended in with the background. And there it had these peculiar legs, like a kangaroo sort of body, a long tail, but the skin sort of like a snake skin, and this long, thin neck. And I realised, also for a minute, I thought, is it a snake that's ate something large and it's digested it? I thought, that's impossible, because a snake's head doesn't move in that jerky motion. And also a snake, you just wouldn't have noticed it. It wouldn't be sitting up there sort of begging. And then when I looked, they had this kind of feeble little legs in the front, which seemed to be sort of practically useless looking at it, to all intents and purposes. What it did, or what it ate, or what it lived on, God alone knows, but it stood about 1'6". That is off the ground. The tail was a good deal longer, and the tail, something like a kangaroo, I should imagine, gave it balance. But it made no attempt to run or to move. It just froze. When it froze, it literally did blend in with the background. Now, if he hadn't pointed it out, I wouldn't have seen it.
And do you know what on earth it might have been? Have you ever thought about it? What it might
I
have
thought
been?
About it a lot, but the only thing is, I said before, I suffer from agoraphobia. I managed to get to and from work quite easily. But the performance, I'm not the world's greatest writer for spelling and all that, hopeless in fact. I often thought of going down one of the museums and trying to sort out what it is or what it wasn't. And I thought to myself, well, the thing is, you're out there for 2 years. How many of these people go out to a place and stay there for 2 years? I mean, another weirdie that we saw in that same sort of line, a tortoise, everybody's seen a tortoise or a terrapin. But have they seen one that runs as fast as a rabbit? And I'm not joking, literally, run as fast as a rabbit. I couldn't believe my eyes. This thing shot across the ground. The boys caught it and we penned it in. But what we didn't know was they used to dig, and they could dig very well too. And he dug his way out overnight. We drove stakes all the way around him to keep him in, fenced in. And we were going to take him back. And of course he just charged this lot all night long. We could hear him clonking against this lot we'd driven in the ground. And that was it. Bonf, he'd gone in the morning. But I couldn't believe my eyes. Same as I was watching television the other day, these nature programmes.
No, stop, I don't want you to get on television.
Well, you see, with the butterflies, normal butterflies flap their wings. We were walking down Mount Opia.
And stop, suddenly, because the aeroplane's too loud.
We were walking down Mount Opia, and I was looking in the front normally, because at that time I was leading scout, and suddenly I see this paper dart whizzing past me. I thought, what flaming idiot, you know. You can't go taking risks like this. And the next thing, another one shot down the other side. And I've turned around to see where they've come from, and I could see quite a few of them coming down. And everyone's behaving quite normally. And when I looked, they weren't paper darts at all. They were, in actual fact, a butterfly of some sort, or a moth or whatever. But they were about 6-inch wingspan. And they were just gliding. No flapping, just gliding. Absolutely astounded me. I thought, well, but then again, there were so many weirdies that you'd never seen before in your life, that this was just another one of them. And the same way that I saw this peculiar animal and other peculiar things, you just assumed that everybody else had seen them. They were just common old garden everyday animals to everybody. Well, the jungle itself struck me as colossally high, terribly dark, but getting to know a little bit about it was, it seemed to me almost like life itself, because you had these tall trees going up hundreds of feet into the air, and with every tree was a vine, a thick vine, as thick as your arm. And for every little tree that you saw starting to grow, there was the vine ready to choke it to death. And then you saw the old trees that had tumbled, and other trees that had been struck by lightning or whatever and come down. And I thought to myself, this is almost like a pattern of life. Disease sets in, and the minute you're born, you're being killed. You're gradually being choked, and everything's fighting for the light.
Did you find it oppressive? Did you enjoy being in it, or did you find it?
I didn't mind. To start with, I was frightened out of my living daylights. I mean, because you saw soldier ants, things like this, which were over an inch long. They did you no harm whatsoever, except if they did bite you, you knew all about it. But very, very seldom did they ever bite you. Most things out there were larger than life. But, I mean, twig insects, things like this, it looked like a piece of twig bouncing up and down on a cobweb, but they weren't at all. Ants were an absolute flaming pest. I mean, they would bite you like blazes. Termites' nests used to just march all day from first sun till sundown. And just before sundown, you'd stop, and they'd just say, all right, halt. And if you weren't going to bash up for 2 or 3 days or whatever, you just stopped where you stopped, and you slept, whether it rained, whatever. That was just too bad. You had no protection. You just lay where you were. But you were soaking wet with sweat. You was always soaking wet anyway.
Stop a second.
You see, you would go through swamps. You'd come out of the swamp. You'd walk along. The sun would dry you for a couple of seconds. The next thing, down comes the downpour of rain. You come through the downpour of rain, you begin to dry off again, then you're sweating through the sun. So once again you're soaking wet. Then you find the easiest way through the jungle is through along a river. So once again you're up to God knows what height of water, until it becomes easier to walk on the bank if it's too deep. And it's freezing cold when it comes out of the rock too, if you get near the part where it actually kind of springs up from the spring. And the thing was, this whole effect was on your feet, absolutely terrible, because your feet were lacerated and bleeding. You could actually walk across the floor and leave a trail of blood under your feet. Everyone had foot rot, everyone had tinea pedis, weeping tinea. Crabs were not unknown, they're quite common. Ticks were another thing. And it seemed every darn thing was pretty awful all the way around. On the same lines, we did have a lecture on snake bites. And they said if you get 2 marks, that's a poisonous snake. If you get more than 2 marks, like a jagged, say 6 marks, then it's not poisonous. Well, on one patrol, I was walking along just after this stupid lecture, and they said the main thing is panic kills, so try and calm them down. I'm walking along, all of a sudden I felt a whack on my shoulder, and I pulled back the pack and looked at my shoulder, and there, sure enough, is 2 marks. My God, panic set in. So I said, medic, medic. And of course, down came the medical pack after a load of kerfuffle. And when they brought the medical pack out, the razor blade, everything else, were red rusty. I thought, my God, how am I going to lance myself with this lot? So I said, right, sharpen up a knife, slash me. To hell with it, just slash, you know, over. And down came the e-balm, looked at it, and said, on it. And I said, what? He said, on it. And I realised what he meant was, one was an ordinary spot and the other one was a hornet sting. But the force that the hornet hit you at felt just like someone throwing a stone at you. Because they came at you with such a wallop, and bang, you really felt the wallop as it hit you. You were wet literally all the time, one way or the other, either through sweat and the amount of salt that you sweated. You had to drink 5 pints of water a day if you could, but on patrol that was practically impossible. Your teeth began to crumble because you used to have to, on some occasions, if you were working on maps that were 15 years old, or from the last war at least, rivers had dried up and disappeared. So where you were hoping to find a river, you didn't find it. So you would maybe go without water for some considerable while, until you come to another stream. After a while, you began to sense where water was. You could almost tell then where water was. So if there was none there, of course there was none there, that was it. But if there was any to be found, you seemed to be able to find it. Part of finding this water was mainly the Ebans showed you could slasher vine, say, and you would get water out of certain vines, so you learn to recognise that vine. Then, by the lie of the land, although you couldn't see it, you just felt it, you began to have this sort of sense for water, where it would be, and you would invariably find it. To a certain extent, you don't know how much your eyes and your nose played a sense in this, but you definitely gained a sort of a primitive kind of instinct, almost. The same way that you could smell other people. English or European sweat and European smell, the body odour, is entirely different to that of the Oriental. You could smell them. In fact, when you would come into danger, you could invariably, I think, you tend to smell them as well as sense them, but not only with your eyes, but also with your nose, and possibly it's just that feeling. Whenever I was coming to that kind of situation, the safety catch would go off, and I'd start moving in a crouched position to make myself a small target, and really skinning my eyes, really keenly looking. And this was, I was never wrong on any of these occasions, neither was I wrong. When you felt safe or secure, you walked along quite nonchalantly, within reason. I mean, obviously, not that nonchalantly, but always with the eye skinning the area. A matchstick, a cigarette, anything that didn't belong in the jungle, you noticed it immediately. Within seconds, you noticed it. A strange smell, the smell of tobacco, you straight away smelled it. Smoke, you'd straight away smell it. It wafted along and it seemed to carry under the veil of the trees right the way through the jungle, so you had no trouble sort of picking up these smells, odours. Sound was another thing that carried a terrific distance. So, of course, we were never allowed to shoot anything. If we had come across a snake or any other thing that might do us harm, you had to finish it off with knives, with a panga. On the odd occasion where you came across scorpions, some of them, scorpions you see normally are very small. Real scorpions that we saw out there were little ones sometimes, but often I've seen them the size of lobsters. The biggest one I ever saw, literally, was the size of a lobster, jet black, blue black. And the chap was sitting up on, it was on guard, and I just got out of my basher and stood up and saw this thing creeping up this anthill towards him where he was sitting on guard. And didn't shout to him because I knew how fast they could move if they wanted to. And they had these massive claws with a stinging tail at the back. And I picked up my panga, and it was the army issue at that time, and I threw it.
Stop.
I picked up my panga and I threw it at the scorpion, and to my horror, the thing just hit the shell and bounced off. Then it turned around to face me. Suddenly I realised I'm unarmed, I've got nothing. But luckily, the guard heard the ping, he turned round, but of course he was only armed with a hatchet, a submachine gun. And he waved to the other chaps, and they immediately came over with their pangas, and their first thing then is always chop the stinger off, which I should have done, but I was frightened that if I would move towards it, it might have gone up the hill and had him long before I could have got to it. So you became fairly adept, fairly quick. You moved very quick because you thought, had to think very quick. Everything had to be done instantaneously. People talk, in fact, they say, oh, it's almost like the Wild West then. Well, the Wild West, obviously, I don't know exactly what it was because I wasn't out there, but certainly, if it's anything like the films, quick on the draw was the thing. I eventually was issued with a shotgun because of sight began to go. I could have that shotgun up, and on a shotgun you had a press button release for the safety catch, and then just a hair trigger. Now, I loved the hair trigger because you only had to touch it and bang, the round had gone. You were firing pig shot, which was 9 rounds, roughly 9 millimetres in size, which had a terrific spread, so you could be 12 foot off a target and still hit it. And it had a terrific knocking down power. A lot of the weapons that they issued later, the American weapons, had no knocking down power. A 303 would lift a man off his feet, a shotgun would lift a man off his feet, and literally at point blank range you could literally say that that was it, bolt, you're going to blow a hole straight through him.
What was the point?
So I came out with the Queen's as a National Serviceman, 1954, and from there on there was no training you could have, apart from the chaps that had come back and probably were washed out anyway, that could set you up for what you were going to be faced with. You had to learn as you went along, and a good man learned quickly, and if he didn't, he died. I was extremely fortunate in that a lot of the action that took place, I always seemed to be missing for one reason or another. Patrols would bump into each other and there'd be a shootout and you'd be killing your own men. Then occasionally people would capture bandits or kill bandits, or bandits would give themselves up. Some of this was done through aerial broadcast and leaflet dropping to try and get them to turn against each other. Kill your leader, give yourself up. One of the things that always surprised me was the chap could say, been with their group for 10 years, give yourself up, and then go back and take you out. Well, it was a war of nerves. There's no two ways about it. The snap of a twig would make you jump, would make you spin, would make you turn. Anything would make you wake up in your sleep. You could be asleep as sound as a bell, and the slightest noise would waken you. In fact, on one occasion, I woke up grabbing my own arm. I was laying on my arm, and when I put my hand, I had my rifle always resting behind me, ready to grab for immediate action. I put my other hand up, inadvertently in my sleep, and I felt this dead hand, or leastways a hand that wasn't mine. I grabbed it quickly, thinking it was a bandit going for my rifle. I woke up holding my own hand. My nerves were completely shattered, completely washed out. I was physically exhausted, and mentally I was absolutely a wreck. My feet were lacerated just like everyone else's. Some chaps went down a lot quicker than me. Some committed suicide, officers and sergeants, and God knows what committed suicide. Some just died. Pneumonia, one chap died of. You felt terribly aggrieved about this. And the whole effect on you, the sum effect on you was, well, with me, I developed agoraphobia, mainly, I think, from going in.